Flags about extreme weather we've all endured together all across the globe.
We are literally engaged in an unprecedented experiment with the one planet that we know of that can support life.
Our communities are disproportionately impacted. We're all seeing that it's the indigenous people, the people of color, the low-income people who have historically suffered the burden of so many other politically driven crises.
There are so many countries that have been systematically plundered over hundreds of years, and this is often described as an ecological debt, climate debt. The whole idea that there are disposable places was always a racist idea, the idea of sacrifice zones. Just treating people in places like garbage.
And welcome to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital on 89.3 WPFW, your Pacifica station for justice and jazz and so much more. I'm Esther Averam. It's Friday, April 22nd, 2016, Earth Day, and we have a jam-packed show for you from D.C. to Flint to New Mexico and beyond. And this is the day after musical icon Prince joined the Ancestors, and a day after it was announced that Harriet Tubman will appear on the $20 bill. I consider Harriet Tubman an original resistor, so we can call her an OR, resistor against slavery, white supremacy, and genocide. This morning, we'll be talking to people on the ground fighting for justice for the residents of Flint, Michigan, who have been poisoned by actions of the state. We'll talk to environmentalists about what has happened since last November's historic Paris Climate Agreement. And we'll catch up with local activists in the DMV who are continuing to wage battle with energy regulators. These regulators continue to approve more drilling, fracking, and mining, despite the stated commitment to curb greenhouse gases. I'm joined in the studio today by Michelle Roberts, National Co-Coordinator of Environmental Justice and Health Alliance for Chemical Policy Reform. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Esther. It's wonderful being here.
And I should add that this is part one for us for Earth Day.
Yeah.
And folks should stay tuned this afternoon for On the Ground's Earth Day special from Paris to D.C. at 3 p.m. So strap in. We have a lot for you in this hour, and we'll be sticking around to take your calls in the next hour. But first, our headlines for Earth Day. This morning, more than 150 leaders are gathering in New York at the United Nations for a ceremony to sign the historic 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. And while many leaders are pushing to make the Paris Agreement legally binding years earlier than expected, experts also say the country's plans to cut fossil fuel emissions are not sufficient, unless all countries, but particularly the largest polluters like the U.S. and China, develop more ambitious plans. The experts say the world could ultimately suffer impacts such as heat waves, fast rising seas, droughts, food shortages, and nature thrown out of balance. Africa's human existence and development is under threat from adverse impacts of climate change. Its population, ecosystems, and biodiversity will all be the major victims of global climate change. This is how the Nairobi-based United Nations Environment Program, this is how clear this program is when it comes to assessing the negative impact of climate change on this continent of 54 countries with a combined population of over 1.2 billion. No continent will be struck as severely by the impacts of climate change as Africa, the program says. More than 90% of the Great Barrier Reef is suffering some level of coral bleaching and will likely never return to its original state. A new study from the Australian Research Council Center of Excellence for Coral Reef Studies released Tuesday confirms. Bleaching occurs when overly warm ocean waters cause coral to expel the algae living inside of it, which turns the coral white and erodes its structures. That, in turn, provides less shoreline protection and destroys natural habitats for marine life. DCI Group, a Washington, D.C. public relations and lobbying firm, is the latest group subpoenaed in an expanding investigation by state attorneys general into the funding of climate change denial by ExxonMobil, according to court filings reviewed by the Center for Media and Democracy. ExxonMobil has now received separate subpoenas from both the New York and U.S. Virgin Islands U.S. attorneys' offices. The Competitive Enterprise Institute and DCI Group have also been subpoenaed by the U.S. Virgin Islands for their records relating to their role in helping ExxonMobil with climate change denial. 17 states' attorneys general, calling themselves AGs United for Clean Power, held a press conference on March 29th announcing increased collaboration between the states in investigating the opposition to tackling climate change. ExxonMobil has become the focus of attention from state attorneys general after separate investigations by Inside Climate News and the LA Times Columbia School of Journalism revealed it had known internally about the threat of climate change for several decades. Inside Climate News was a finalist for a Pulitzer for its work on the story. And more deaths from extreme heat, longer allergy seasons, increasingly polluted air and water, diseases transmitted by mosquitoes, and ticks spreading farther and faster. These are among the health risks that could be exacerbated by global warming coming in the coming decades, the Obama administration warned in a recent report. The study, more than 300 pages long and several years in the making, focuses on what the White House has described as one of the gravest threats to the nation, major health problems associated with climate change. While every American could be affected, administration officials said, the brunt of the harm is most likely to fall disproportionately on the most vulnerable populations, such as pregnant women, children, the poor, the elderly, minorities, immigrants, and people with disabilities. Now for some more upbeat news. 20-year-old Destiny Watford of Baltimore was one of the winners of the Goldman Environmental Prize for organizing to stop a trash incinerator from being built in Baltimore's Curtis Bay neighborhood, which already has the worst air pollution in the city. She began the campaign when she was only 17 years old. The awardees were honored in a program Wednesday night at the Ronald Reagan Building here in D.C. The Goldman Prize honors grassroots environmental heroes from the six inhabited continental regions, Africa, Asia, Europe, islands and island nations, North America, and South and Central America. The prize recognizes individuals for sustained and significant efforts to protect and enhance the natural environment, often at great personal risk. Berta Caceres, the Honduran environmentalist who was recently assassinated at her home, was awarded the Goldman Prize last year and was honored posthumously this year. While some attendees were moved by this ceremony, some told this show On the Ground that more needs to be done to hold corporations accountable that are seeking to exploit resources in these developing countries. Pipeline company Kinder Morgan has suspended its plan to build a fracked gas pipeline from Pennsylvania to Massachusetts, citing poor demand for its gas in a statement released late Wednesday. Pipeline opponents are cheering the decision. The pipeline would have cost over $3 billion and spanned nearly 200 miles, according to the Boston Globe. Now, at the Democracy Awakening demonstrations on the Mall last week, I spoke to DMV environmentalist Ted Glick about pipelines and other fights against dirty energy. So I'm talking to Ted Glick out here at Democracy Spring, Democracy Awakening, and he's with the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and Beyond Extreme Energy. So you've been doing continuing actions at FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, right? So tell us what those continuing actions are about.
Well, we've actually been taking action at FERC since July of 2014. That particular action was focused on the Cove Point, the export terminal that unfortunately is being built in Cove Point, Maryland, although there are people and groups who continue to fight it, try to prevent it from being built, or if it is built, prevent it from actually going into operation. But ever since then, there's been this growing movement linking organizations, grassroots groups around the country who are fighting against pipelines, new gas pipelines, compressor stations that push the gas along through the pipes, storage terminals, and then other export terminals around the country. And they're literally, there's now a organized, coordinated, connected movement. It's centered along the East Coast from New England down to North Carolina, actually down into the Deep South. There was just a victory in Georgia, where the Republican-dominated legislature and the Republican, I believe a Republican governor, enacted a one-year moratorium on any new gas pipeline that was being proposed for down there. It's really interesting, this whole issue of gas pipelines. It unites people across a lot of ideological lines. For conservatives, Republicans, you know, white landowners, they're concerned about eminent domain being used to take their land to build this pipeline, or what's going to happen after a pipeline is built on their land in terms of the risks that are involved, in terms of the impact on their farming or whatever. So, you know, we've all this time continued to keep up the pressure at FERC. We were there just this morning with about 40 people from Democracy Spring demonstrating, taking action, leafleting the FERC employees. And we actually are seeing some cracks. There are some changes happening little by little at FERC. They're taking much longer to make decisions about pipelines. They actually turned down a pipeline, first time, from what we can gather, first time in 30 years, they actually turned down a proposed pipeline, an application from a gas company, from a pipeline company in Oregon, in the state of Oregon. They said the reason was because there was so much opposition among landowners for a pipeline connected to an export terminal. There were something like 92% of all of the landowners had refused to allow the company that wants to build the pipeline to come onto their land. And as a result of that, plus the fact that the company building the pipeline has not gotten any firm commitments so far from gas companies that would actually send gas through the pipe, they actually rejected, they turned down the application. That's never happened in 30 years.
And more good news about the environment. To anybody who's been reading the headlines on investment into clean energy production, it's clear that India has been heavily backing solar power. In recent times, the nation has unveiled a string of ambitious solar projects, including the world's first 100% solar-powered airport and what is slated to become the world's largest solar power station. One of the consequences of all this ongoing investment in infrastructure is that the cost of providing solar power in India is becoming increasingly affordable, to the point where the country's energy minister now says that solar power is a more cost-effective option than the old fossil fuel staple, coal. And finally, Oscar-nominated director Josh Fox of Gasland has a new movie, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change. In this movie, he investigates climate change, traveling to 12 countries on 6 continents. The film acknowledges that it may be too late to stop some of the worst consequences and asks, what is it that climate change can't destroy? What is so deep within us that no calamity can take it away? The film is currently at the IFC Center in New York through the 28th with a discussion every night. The website is howtoletgomovie.com. And those are headlines and happenings. When we come back, fighting back in Flint. Stay with us.
Water way out of balance. Stop with this goof ice water challenge. The ocean ain't your mug trash can. Living in the gas land. Fire water flow straight out of the faucet. Now fire water flow straight out of the faucet. We been the planet. Mother Earth is a caustic. So what the fuck is cracking with all this fracking? They go fuck around and release the cracking. Trouble in the water used to mean that a shark could eat you. Now you got a better chance of bumping in the shark, Keisha. I'm part creature. Gorilla monsoon tracks for Jesus to talk on. Disease to disease for Jesus to walk on. Heal our Mother Earth, cause she way too big for us to put chalk on. Good music.
Trouble in the water. Trouble in the water. Children, trouble in the water.
That was Trouble in the Water with Common, Malik Youssef Kamasi, Aaron Fresh, Chocolate, and Lacey Kay on the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. I'm Esther Avam with Michelle Roberts in the studio with me today. Well, this week, the ongoing crisis of poison water in Flint, Michigan made the headlines again with the first charges brought against three low-level city and state officials for the lead-contaminated water that is still flowing through the taps in the city. Two state employees have been charged with misleading the U.S. government about the problem, Michigan Department of Environmental Quality employees Stephen Bush and Michael Prisby. Meanwhile, a Flint employee, Michael Glasgow, is charged with altering water test results. The charges come as Michigan's Republican Governor Rick Snyder said he has not been questioned by prosecutors in connection with the crisis. Protesters have called for Governor Snyder to resign over his handling of the Flint water crisis, which began when the city's unelected emergency manager, appointed by Governor Snyder, switched the source of the city's drinking water from the Detroit system to the corrosive Flint River, and the water corroded Flint's aging pipe, causing lead to leach into the drinking water. Well, with me to discuss how residents are fighting for justice is Anjali Weicker, attorney with the National Resources Defense Council in their Chicago office, and also Reverend Alan Overton, pastor of Second Missionary Baptist Church of Monroe, and also a member of Concerned Pastors for Social Action. Reverend Overton is a plaintiff, along with others, in a lawsuit filed by the NRDC. Good morning, Anjali. Good morning, Reverend Overton.
Good morning. How are you? Glad to be on your show this morning.
Okay. Well, while we make sure we get her on the line, Reverend Overton, can I first get your reaction as someone in the Flint community to these charges brought this week?
Of course, we're still looking at what they're doing with the charges. We're thankful that someone has begin to proceed to hold someone accountable, but we're awfully alarmed that they grabbed the lowest level people to charge them first, knowing that they were just taking orders from their superiors.
Right. Right. And I know there were lots of calls, for example, as we mentioned, for the governor to resign. And from where you sit, do you think that he will face scrutiny under this investigation or any other?
We're not sure. You know, the attorney general has said no one above the law. So we're hoping that he's sincere in that comment and he's going to go out and find the facts and the truth and move forward in that process. We're hoping that whoever is responsible for this, that they're held accountable, and we do feel the governor does hold some responsibility in this crisis that we're in.
Okay. And Anjali Weicker, attorney with the NRDC, one of the frustrations, I guess, as we look on from the outside, is that nothing seems to be getting done. You know, some people still aren't even getting bottled water or filters, and I didn't realize that until yesterday when we spoke. So tell us about the lawsuit you filed, and who is it representing?
Sure, I'd be happy to talk about it. You know, it might be helpful to provide a little bit of context, because I know that there is so much going on in Flint in terms of litigation. We at the NRDC actually got involved and met when we were invited by Concerned Pastors and others, including ACLU of Michigan, back around end of fall of last year. And in October, we started by first looking into the situation and serving a petition on the federal EPA. This is obviously the federal agency that asking it to act pursuant to its emergency powers to address what we believe was a substantial and imminent threat to public health. Then in November, we served our notice of intent to sue, and we served this against various state officials in the city of Flint. And the reason we gave the 60 days notice was because the statute that we ultimately sued under, which was in January, is the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, which requires that people who are suing to provide 60 days notice. So our lawsuit, again, which was filed in January, is on behalf of Concerned Pastors for Social Action and another Flint resident, Melissa Mays, along with NRDC and ACLU of Michigan as plaintiffs. And our argument is that the government is simply not complying with the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, which is, again, the federal environmental law at issue, that requires that officials who are operating the water system test it for lead and treat it to make sure that it's properly controlling for corrosion. So really our suit asks for claims for claims. One is that, you know, again, the government is failing to treat the water, that the government has failed to test the water properly for lead contamination, and that the government should properly notify residents of the testing results and report their activities to state regulators. Now, you know, with any federal lawsuit, you know, this can take a very long time. And I should mention that our lawsuit is different. There are multiple lawsuits that have been filed to date. Our lawsuit is not seeking money damages, unlike many of the other lawsuits out there. Instead, what we're seeking is prospective ongoing relief to ensure that this kind of situation and a horrific travesty never happens again.
Okay, so since it will take a while for the lawsuit to be effective in any way, what kind of relief is there for the people in the meantime?
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of the underlying lawsuit, what we're seeking is a replacement of the damaged pipes and replacement of the lead service lines. And we're also seeking some health oversight for people in Flint. Now, again, as you just noted, lawsuits take a very long time, unfortunately. And after we filed the lawsuit, you know, we started hearing from people in Flint these really incredible stories from activists on the ground, including people like Pastor Overton and others, who had been telling us about residents who simply hadn't been either hearing about the Flint crisis or hadn't been receiving bottled water, delivery of water. And, you know, it's clear from news reports that the water is not going to be safe for many more months. And so what we did was we filed what's called a motion for preliminary injunction. And basically what this motion described was the stories that we were hearing that residents in Flint have literally waited days or even weeks to get water in response to requests from the city. So the city operates a 211 helpline, and people can call this 211 helpline either to get bottled water delivery or to get filters in their homes. And basically, operators have been telling residents to go to the fire stations or their local churches to get free water. Now, what about the people who are homebound? What about the people who don't have transportation or who aren't able to get on a bus, you know, and carry you know, an entire case of water back to their homes?
Right.
So many residents were just really discouraged by these responses, and simply, you know, we were hearing stories that people were simply not using the government services and instead relying on friends or families or even having to pay other people for water delivery. And so, you know, it's quite striking to hear that there were pockets within the community in Flint that, you know, again, were either not getting serviced, not getting adequate water, not getting filters, or not knowing how to use the filters, and in some cases, you know, at that time not even having heard about the water crisis itself. It's really hard to believe, but it's the unfortunate reality despite all the international attention. So what we've asked...
Michelle actually has a question for you, but before I turn it over to her, I wanted to ask you, in terms of this relief that is available, is this being supplied by the city, the state, or the federal government? Who's responsible there on the ground?
Well, our motion is seeking relief from the defendants in our case, which are the state officials and the city, and what we're asking for is a robust water delivery system to be put in place to ensure that people are getting served while the water up, while the pipes themselves and the underlying issues are resolved.
Okay. So we thought that maybe this water delivery was happening, but it's not.
Right. It's happening. It's not happening sufficiently.
Okay.
Or adequately.
Okay, Michelle.
Anjali and Reverend Overton, thank you so much for joining us. You know, on the heels of Charleston, West Virginia, the folks in Charleston ask, why was it that the National Guard was not dispatched on the ground to bring water deliverable systems such as what we do when we go overseas to the Persian Gulf and other places? Were you contacted by National Guard, and where was your where is today your public health department in all of this?
Yeah, we have asked for the National Guard to come in, and they brought the National Guard in only to deliver bottled water. They have not set up a potable water locations where they would set up what I would call a water buffalo to distribute water in all communities. They have not done that. They have not given an answer why they haven't done it, but as of to this date, they have not done that. Our health department, I must admit, was moving very slow in this crisis. They picked up the pace now. Everyone wanted to somewhat cover up this problem because of the population that resides in the city of Flint, and we feel that that population was neglected and overlooked because Flint is 65% African-American and 45% poverty. So we think that we feel that they overlooked those people because they were the least of these, and no one would cry out for them. So that's what happened.
So, Reverend Overton, speaking of, you know, the people of Flint, the characterization of the very poor people of Flint, you know, as the least of these, and how the city is not looking after this population or the state or, as far as we can tell, the federal government either, can you paint a picture for us of perhaps a parishioner or someone who is a part of your coalition who has been impacted by this crisis? You know,
well,
very often we aren't seeing the faces, we aren't hearing those voices in as this crisis continues on.
Let me paint this picture for you. There's a mother that we are aware of. She does not have transportation. It was in the middle of the winter when this crisis was declared, and she got a grocery cart, and she went to the fire station, who would only give her 2 cases of water. So she left the fire station with 2 cases of water in her grocery cart, and she began to push her grocery cart through the snow to the next water location, which was a church, to try to get more water for her family. And she had to do that over and over again. A family of four, she was telling us that it took over 100 bottles of water for one person in her family to take care of all their needs in one day.
Wow. Wow. And she is still making this trip? This is still part of her routine?
No. There's a church that we know have adopted that family, and they're delivering the water to that family. There's another family. There's a senior. The National Guards brought her the water, put it at her front door, and that's where they left. Well, she needed water upstairs so that she could do some bathing. She's a senior. She couldn't get the water upstairs to do whatever she needed for her baby. So she was limited in what she could do because they were not willing to assist her with what she needed. Flint is in a crisis situation where we take for granted when we walk to our tap and turn the water on, and we can take our shower, we can take a bath, we can brush our teeth. Flint cannot do that. If they turn the tap on, they're running out poison water. Now they have filters, and they're saying that the filters will work. Well, the filters are only for the kitchen. And anything you have to do in the bathroom as far as brushing your teeth, washing your face, there's no filter for that. And right. Then we found out that even the filters in some homes were not working because the lead was too high for those filters. They only take out so many parts per billion, and those filters were not working. So we're in a crisis situation. The government has not moved as swiftly as we felt they should. We do have a new mayor in the city of Flint who's doing the very best she can to bring this crisis to the attention of America and force the government, the state government, as well as the federal government. And I don't want to take that lightly because oftentimes we think that it was just a state problem. This was not just a state problem. The federal government is ran, the EPA is ran by the federal government. They failed this community just as much as the government did.
Right.
They did not come on the ground as we requested them to come and do their own testing and look at the system for themselves. They refused to come, and they would not come and take a look at what was going on in this community. Therefore, they were part of the neglect of this community also.
Yeah. Now, Michelle, when we spoke about Flint not that long ago, we were talking about how so much of the issue is almost framed as a structural problem mm-hmm. in terms of pipes and how this is a structural problem throughout the country. But you were saying how it's also structural racism that, yeah. and I want you to kind of elaborate on that point more since we're talking about Flint today.
Sure, yeah. In many of our cities, we find that when you find these aging infrastructures, where these communities, the communities located around them are more than likely black and brown communities, communities of color. And then as you look across the rural landscape, you see the same thing. You see poverty, poor white, poor people of color, with the neglect of proper sewer systems, sanitary sewer systems. That's the work that I actually used to do. I worked in water, and you saw the disparities even in a city like Wilmington, Delaware, where it's flooding. In the Southbridge community, you have floodgates that don't work, that are inoperable. People know this, but still, it's still not addressed. And in addition to that, the lack of enforcement. So you have communities such as what you heard Reverend Overton expound on. The community of Flint has been saying this for years, just like the community of Charleston, West Virginia. And then when the crisis occurs, just as you heard me ask Reverend Overton, was the National Guard or anyone else dispatched to really help them? They were not. But, yeah. you know, and there again, this is institutionalized racism that yeah. we must really address.
Yeah.
Can I add to that?
Yes.
One of the unique situations with Flint is that in this crisis, this did not have to be. Flint was on a good water source from the Detroit water source. Mm-hmm. We received our water from Detroit. And the city officials at that time and the state officials at that time made a determination to take them to the Flint River, which we got off the Flint River 50-plus years ago right. because it was corrosive.
Right.
They did not have to move us from one water source to the other. It's not like we were on a water source and our pipes became so corrosive that this happened. They switched our water source
right.
with no regard for the health and welfare mm-hmm. of the people.
And they switched it back for GM, right? Mm-hmm. Because the water was corroding their engines mm-hmm. parts, but they wouldn't switch it back for the people, the human beings. So, wow. Okay. So, we have to wrap up our segment, but, I want to know if you want to add anything, Anjali Weicker, attorney with the NRDC National Resources
Defense Council,
and also, Reverend Overton from Michigan.
I just want to say thank you for covering this. And, you know, I think many things went wrong in Flint. There's no question about that. And, you know, while there are National Guard out there, they're certainly not sufficient and cohesive services that are being provided even today. And, you know, people have been failed by every level of government. And I think really what has been one of the most troubling aspects has been the lack of transparency. I hope that we'll move forward and the community in Flint can heal.
Okay. Reverend Overton?
I likewise want to take the opportunity to thank you for allowing us to come and tell our story about a crisis that's going on in the city of Flint. And we continue to solicit your prayers and any support that you can extend to the city of Flint will be much appreciated.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining me. I've been speaking with Anjali Weicker, attorney with the National Resources Defense Council in their Chicago office, and Reverend Alan Overton, pastor of Second Missionary Baptist Church of Monroe and a member of Concerned Pastors for Social Action. Thank you again for joining me on the ground.
Thank you.
Okay, when we come back, how has the Paris Climate Agreement impacted environmental justice? Stay with us. Baltimore.
little better than the day in Baltimore. Does anybody hear us pray for Michael Brown or Freddie Gray? This is more than the absence of war.
Baltimore by Prince on the Ground, ontheground.org. I'm Esther Averin with Michelle Rogers on Earth Day. Roberts. And as we said at the top of the show, this morning more than 150 world leaders are gathering in New York at the United Nations for a ceremony to sign the historic 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. And while many leaders are pushing to make the Paris Agreement legally binding years earlier than originally expected, experts also say that countries' plans to cut fossil fuel emissions are not sufficient. Unless all countries, but particularly the world's largest polluters like the U.S. and China, develop more ambitious plans, the experts say the world could ultimately suffer impacts such as heat waves, fast-rising seas, droughts, food shortages, and nature thrown out of balance. Well, with us for this segment is Jose T. Bravo, Executive Director of the Just Transition Alliance, and also Richard Moore of Los Jardines Institute, located in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and National Co-Coordinator of the Environmental Justice and Health Alliance. Good morning, Jose. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Good morning, Esther. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning.
So I guess I'll go to you first, Jose. You were in Paris for the climate summit last November. So I wanted you to react to the signing today and give me your impressions about what this agreement will do and how this will impact environmental justice issues around the country.
Yes, thank you for having me on your radio show. Happy Mother Earth Day today to everyone.
Thank you.
And so I was in Paris, and one of my responsibilities was to monitor the negotiations for folk that had sent me from the United States to talk about environmental justice issues. And so in a nutshell, the agreement that was reached in France, if it stands as it is right now, it would put us up in the level of a 3 degrees rise in temperature. And but it was actually the way that it was actually said to folks was that it would put us in the 2 degrees to 1.5 to 2 degrees. And So what that really means to us is that in environmental justice communities around the world, by the way, not just in the United States, we stand to have more impact from climate-related catastrophes, climate-related illnesses, and also the displacement of people from the global south. So it's important for us to understand that, you know, this agreement comes with carbon trading. And carbon trading first was put forth in a community in South Central Los Angeles, an African-American and Latino community. Then it was picked up at a national level. Now it's at a global level with this agreement.
So before we go into that, we should probably explain what that is. Explain what carbon trading is.
What carbon trading is that every industry is given a certain amount of credits. And if you don't use your credits, you can actually sell those credits to other industries so that they can actually raise the amount of pollution that they emit.
Right.
So that's carbon trading.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that it's being done at the UN level through this climate agreement is that the North can pollute at the rate that it's currently polluting if it buys and promotes systems in the global South to absorb the carbon that the North is putting out. So that what that means to us in the environmental justice movement is what we call the shifting of burden. So the pollution of the North, the burden of that is now being shifted to the South. And the South is the area of the planet that least produces carbon emissions. So the United States is, for us, is implementing what we call climate
colonialism.
Mm-hmm. Colonialism, yes.
Yeah. So, Richard, how much has this been, I mean, what has been your experience in terms of trying to raise these issues within this larger, I suppose, more publicized, more organized climate justice movement?
Well, let me, again, thank you all for doing this program. And, you know, I just want to just very quickly take us back just for 1 second so that we can ground ourselves just for a minute here. For those of us, and I think many of the listeners that are listening to the program this morning will very clearly remember what I'm saying. For those of us that come out of the civil rights movement and in some cases liberation movements and human rights movements and so on, if we just take a quick step back to the 1960s, we'll remember that Dr. King called for the poor people mobilization to Washington, D.C., and thousands of us from all over the country, caravans, bus, car, whatever way we could get there, we were moving to Washington. So that's a very important historical moment. I say that because, as you all know, that many of us lived actually around the Lincoln Memorial, and it was called then Resurrection City. I'm saying this because many of our sisters and brothers that traveled from throughout the U.S. to come to Washington were protesting various kind of activities, lack of child care, health-related issues, unemployment, land grants, water rights. I mean, whatever we think about, we were all working on different issues. So I say that in this reference because in the late 60s, and when your first Earth Day took place in 1970, the elders, as we were making that drive to Washington, constantly said to us two or three things. One, never forget where you came from. Two, always remember those that make it possible for you to be. And thirdly, give back to others what's been given to you. So I'm saying that because for many of us as young people, when we came back from Washington, D.C. after spending several months in D.C., we began to survey our communities and say, what issues are important to our folk in our communities? If we're to form a youth organization, a strong grassroots community-based organization, what issues are important? I'm flagging this quickly as we move through that history because one of the things that was identified here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and primarily Latino, Chicano, Mexicano, African-American community was many of the industries that were located in and around our neighborhoods. So we began then to take a deeper look at these issues, the petrochemical industry, dog foods, dog food factories, slaughterhouses, landfills, hog farms, chicken farms, whatever all of that was. Now, that's important to the history we're discussing here today, because when in 1970, when the first Earth Day, National Earth Day activities had taken place as a community-based organization here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, we contacted many of the environmental groups, and we asked for their support, specifically around some of the outrageous conditions that was being brought about by the sewage plant that was located in our community. Smells, rats, roaches, mosquitoes, birds, whatever all of that was. And so the environmental group said to us back then, well, we're sorry, but your issues are not environmental issues. And that's very, very important, I say, to where we are today in the environmental and economic justice movement. That's very, very important to us. And so we said to them, and I'll say this, Esther, in respect, we said, there's a tree in the middle of the sewage plant. And our understanding is that an owl has a nest in that tree. So will you join us for protesting against these conditions from this sewage plant to protect the owl? Because the owl is very, very important to us. But what about the people that live around us? This has been a long struggle. Mm. It's been a long haul. And we're winning more than we're losing. And so we can give some of those primary examples as we move forward.
Well, thank you for that. I think Michelle has a question or comment.
Yeah, thank you for that, Richard. So can you tell us when the First People of Color Summit happened and those principles were created, how is it that the issues of protecting the rights of Mother Earth and all of those things came to be with respect to the principles and where we are today in our alignment with other countries like Bolivia and Venezuela as it relates to the protection of Mother Earth rights?
Yes, thank you. And thank you for that question, Michelle. I needed to make that earlier comment just to ground us a little bit. You know, there's always been these discussions in government agencies and other entities that people of color, Native Indigenous people, are too busy dealing with environmental and conservation issues. And that's why when the flag is there, whether we called it environmental justice, whether we called it, the impacts on low-income working class communities, whatever we called it, we have been working on it. So what we convened a meeting and started the discussions in the late 80s, in 1990, of groups that we had been networking with, grassroots groups throughout this country, and said, look, can we come together, sisters and brothers, as people of color? Can we come together as Native Indigenous people? Can we talk about the question of environmentalism and conservation? So we decided to convene the first national, first national People of Color Leadership Summit that was convened in 1991. And it brought hundreds upon hundreds of us together, representing not as individuals, but representing organizations with constituencies. In that process, we said that we have to look at the question of environmentalism and conservationism. So we redefined in 1991 environmentalism as where we work, where we live, where we play, where we pray, and where we go to school, where we learn. Out of that also said, so environmental and conservationism to us meant a little bit of everything as we looked at our communities and the impacts on our communities and the beautifulness and so on of many of our communities and our community leaders. So we also then said we have to take it a step further. We have to develop the principles of environmental justice. So out of that convening came then another historical document from the environmental justice movement was the principles of environmental justice. So we left out of there. We left out of there in 1991 in Washington, D.C., crying together, laughing together, smiling together, and a commitment together that we would work for the rest of our lives towards making our community and workers, be our communities not only to be a better place for us to live, but also a better place for those workers that were working inside those facilities and under some pretty outrageous working conditions. That's where the principles were founded.
You know, we're running out of time. We never have enough time, right? But I wanted to jump to the Clean Power Plan. And I do know that this is something that's happening right now, and environmental justice organizations are definitely connecting some of the history that you're talking about in terms of the impacts on our communities. Can you talk about that? Would that be Richard to talk
Jose.
About that? Jose, could you talk about this Clean Power Plan in the context of our conversation today?
Yes, I can talk about that, and I just want to really quickly say that with the Paris Agreement, we only have 10 years to do what we need to do in order to stay under 3 degrees. And the last part of that is that this agreement does not include any language in regards to reducing the use of fossil fuels. Hmm. It was intentionally left out. So,
that
in essence tells you who was at the table.
Mm-hmm.
So, moving forward to the Clean Power Plan, we have a lot of concerns in the environmental justice movement.
Let's say what it is first.
The Clean Power Plan is a plan put out by the Obama administration to reduce the use of carbon, primarily coal, to phase out power plants that use coal, but it also talks about alternative energies. And for us, I think that's the danger point. The danger point, because it's not necessarily only talking about renewable energy such as solar and wind. It's also talking about incineration of biomass, which for us in the environmental justice movement, we have a legacy of fighting incinerators in many communities. And this Clean Power Plan, if it goes through as planned, there's a possibility that thousands of incinerators will come online. Right now in the environmental justice movement, there's about 4 or 5 incinerators being fought by communities of color and low-income communities. And this plan takes us backwards. So that's one. The second is along the rim of the Grand Canyon, the Havasupai tribe for 30 years have been fighting to stop uranium mining. And what we've seen as of late, maybe last 2 months, 3 months, is that those mines are getting re-permitted to come back online. So we're thinking, and there's a strong possibility, we try to get Ms. Clinton to talk about this in her campaign, but she wouldn't. And this is the fact that part of that plan would include nuclear energy.
Hmm.
So again,
wow.
You know, we're talking about an impact that primarily has impacted indigenous communities, and that the fact is that uranium is mined and indigenous communities are targeted to put nuclear waste in. And lastly, I think it's super important for us to understand that, you know, the devil's in the details. What they're not telling us is that, you know, and people are denying all these things around fracking. That's also something that the administration sees as a viable source of energy.
Right.
For our communities, it's not a good thing.
Right. And we know that what fracking is causing around the country. So I'm going to have to wrap it up there, unfortunately, but we'll definitely have you back. And this is an ongoing conversation that we're committed to have here in Washington, D.C., in the belly of the beast.
Yes.
And hopefully some of these regulators and these public officials are hearing us, and we can have a voice here on the ground. So I've just been speaking to Jose Bravo, Executive Director of the Just Transition Alliance, and Richard Moore of the Los Jardines Institute, located in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you
for having me.
Okay. Thank you, friends.
Okay, and that will do it for us today on the ground. Thanks again to Richard Moore, Jose Bravo, Anjali Weicker, the Reverend Alan Overton, Michelle Roberts, DJ Wahid, and thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella. And thank you so much for listening. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows, including our past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the next hour when I will take your story of the week during Friday's open mic edition of Community Watch and Comment. And those will include your comments on the passing of Prince, and we'll kind of transition into a kind of tribute to him at the bottom of the hour. And don't forget our Earth Day special, our second part of our Earth Day special today at 3 p.m. Raise your voice out there. Peace.